When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
You won't find a better deal on science-backed pregnancy supplements than at Ritual's Black Friday sale. Get what you really deserve, like a prenatal you can trust. Made with bioavailable key nutrients, it even earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. Save 40% on your first month at ritual.com/pregnancy support. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Lifestyle with Alan T.
I'm talking now with Bill McCormick. It's a book called Making It Up As You Go Along. It was built on a series of light-hearted Facebook accounts of his time in the music business. Making It Up As You Go Along is the story of Bill McCormick's journey through the outer reaches of the music business in the 60s and the 70s. And now I hope we got him on the line. Are you there, Bill?
I am indeed. Yes, Alan.
Can you hear me okay now?
I can now, thanks.
Excellent, yeah, I knew it would work. I'm playing, I don't know if you probably recognise it, I'm playing Bundles from the Soft Machine behind us.
Oh, right, yep.
Okay,
that's
now...
A period bit beyond my knowledge.
Well, I wasn't quite sure, but I thought you might be interested in it. I was actually looking, I was doing some research and see if I can find something that was, obviously, as you quite rightly say, far more relevant for you. But tell us about your life, because obviously I've been sort of looking at your background, quite interesting and fascinating. And obviously, the music around the 60s and 70s, I think, was the most exciting period of music of all time.
Well, I would agree with you, not just because I was involved in it. Things did change a huge lot in the 60s in particular. And I was fortunate to meet an important guy called Robert Wyatt.
Robert Wyatt,
who
yeah.
was in the Soft Machine and then had a whole load of his own solo albums. It's his 80th birthday today, I think.
Today, is it? Oh, congratulations
so, yeah.
to Robert. Wow, yeah.
yeah so
we're all about the same age, buddy.
So I met him, my mum and Robert's mum worked at the same school, and we were invited
wow.
round when my mum said, oh, my sons are interested in pop music, mm-hmm. she said, Robert's mother said, oh, come round for lunch. So we did, and we met Robert and the rest of the band, because they all lived in Robert Wyatt's mum's house in West Dulwich, which they'd painted with psychedelic colours and whatever's outside the front. I think my father and mother were a bit bewildered by it all, but, you know...
As they always were.
They at least they were polite. And,
that's nice.
We had lunch, and then at the end of it, as we were leaving, Robert casually said, oh, if you're in the area, pop in, have a cup of tea. Well, it happened to be on my route to and from school, so I used to pop in pretty much daily. And in those days, they would open the door and say, oh, God, we haven't seen you since, what, yesterday? have a cup of tea. And Robert gave me an education in particularly jazz music. Lots of John Coltrane and Charlie
wow.
Mingus.
Excellent.
And then a few weeks later, we went and saw Soft Machine play their first ever gig at a party in Kingston.
Yeah.
And that was it. You know, I wanted that lifestyle. I wanted to be that
Absolutely.
Person up on stage. And so I rooted around my school, which was a place called Dulwich College in South East London. And I came across a guy called then Phil Target Adams, who was the only person I knew who had an electric guitar. And so we formed a band, and eventually we found ourselves a drummer and some other musicians, a guy called Charles Hayward was the drummer. And we would play around the school. We'd end up on occasions playing to 300 or 400 kids from different schools who would all come and pile in there.
So the band was called, was it Matching Mole?
No, that was a bit later on. That was the band I formed with Robert.
Right. That's the one you did with Robert. This is before that.
Was a couple of years later. The school band was called, rejoicing in the name of Pooh and the Ostrich. We all had silly names in those days.
That's true.
And then 69, Phil and I both left. And we went on, we carried on, influenced by what the Soft Machine was doing, and we formed a new band. Charles Hayward, the drummer from school, he left a bit later than us, but he joined. And then we put an advert, as you did in those days, into the back pages of the Melody Maker looking for a keyboard player.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, we get a new keyboard player, and it turns out that he's also been at Dulwich College.
All four of us. How amazing.
And we called the band Quiet Sun, and we were singularly unsuccessful. And then in the spring of 71, we played a gig at Portsmouth Polytechnic, and we were supporting a band called Symbiosis, which was like a pickup jazz band.
Yes.
And Robert Wyatt sometimes played with it, and that night he was there. So it was the first time he ever saw me play.
Mm-hmm.
And then, actually, when they finished their set, we were invited upstage on to jam with them. And then, a couple of months later, we decided we weren't getting anywhere. So Phil went off and replied to another advert in the back of the Melody Maker for a guitar player. And the band that he then proceeded to join happened to be called Roxy Music. And Phil changed his name to his mother's maiden name, Manzanera, and went on to become a guitar hero for the next, how many decades.
You never know what's going to be around the corner those days, did you?
That was the thing. And then I got a phone call. I was working in the civil service. I just needed a job, getting some money.
Got to pay the bills,
absolutely. And I got a call from Robert saying, come down to my place in Notting Hill. Got a couple of other musicians coming along.
Fabulous.
And you'll see what comes up. So I went, civil service, playing in a band with Robert Wyatt, not much of a choice. So off I went down to Notting Hill, and that became Matching Mole. And we recorded a couple of albums with a guy called David Sinclair, who was the keyboard player with a band called Caravan.
Well, obviously you carried something, because you recorded for CBS.
Well, Robert, the Soft Machine's contract was with CBS,
right.
And of course they had their rights over Robert's, firstborn and God knows what else afterwards. So we recorded two albums for CBS, and then sadly the band broke up. Financial pressures, frankly, it was I think getting to Robert being the leader of a and being responsible for other people's well-being, as it were. And so we've just finished recording a second album, done a tour of Europe, and it was all over.
My goodness.
So that was a bit abrupt, but I sort of carried on with things. Did a couple of tracks for a guy called Brian Eno, who went on to work with Bowie and all sorts of people.
Oh, God, yes.
On his first album. And then Phil, by that stage, Phil Manzanera, as he is now, had become pretty successful. And so he got to do a solo album, as you did in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided that not only was he going to do his own solo album, he booked a studio basically through the day. So in the daytime, they did his solo album. And in the evenings, what was then Quiet Sun came back in, and we recorded the album that we'd been rehearsing and playing to nobody 3 years before.
Right.
And that was released it's 50 years ago this year.
Incredible.
And as a recognition of the fact that 50 years ago you released this album, we've actually just gone into the studio, and we're going to do a 50th anniversary edition with new material as well as the old album as well. So that will be a new Quiet Sun album, will be coming out later on this year.
Now, do you mind looking here, that it says you toured the UK supporting XTC and Peter Gabriel? Wow.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, that was the last band I was in. It was a band called Random Hold, which of course heavily populated by ex-students from Dulwich College.
Wow.
So the guitar player is a guy called David Rhodes, who subsequently has worked with Peter Gabriel on every studio album he's done ever since.
Yes, yeah.
Guy called David Ferguson was a keyboard player, did a lot of BBC soundtrack music afterwards, mm-hmm. and he was also the chairman of an organisation called the British Academy of Songwriters and Composers that do things like the Ivor Novello Awards. Sadly, he died about 12 years ago from cancer. We did that touring with Peter Gabriel. I mean, one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. He used to go on stage before we went on as the support band. Most, you know, support bands, usually most people don't want to be have them get in the way of things. He would go on stage and introduce us and say, "Look, please give this band a listen to."
Yeah, yeah.
We toured with him. We went, did everything the same. I mean, we, you know, same hotels, same flights, you name it. We weren't the support band. We were part of a family. It was fantastic.
That's nice, yeah.
He is such a, only apart from being a brilliant musician, such a lovely guy.
I think something that's back in that time, and I think obviously it's changed a lot now, but back then in the 60s and 70s, and I know I did a series of interviews last year with who's now sadly passed away, was Dr. Gerald Travin, who was one of the main engineers back in the late 60s, 70s. It's not who he worked with, it's who he didn't work with. I mean, they're just... And we talked about that, and of course my partner was in the rock scene in New York in the late 70s, and I did a lot of gigs at CBGBs in Kansas City, and she had a band called Student Teachers, and she got to know David Bowie very well, and she was engaged to one of the members of Blondie for a while, Jimmy Destri, who was the keyboard player.
So she
told me some amazing stories about that time, as you can imagine.
But of course,
it was like a family because, you know, they'd go down, she hung out with the Ramones and B-52s and all the Talking Heads and all these sort of wonderful, wonderful sort of acts who'd done extremely well. But there was a lot that didn't do well, you know. But, I mean, at the same time, you just didn't think of it as being abnormal because you were around other slight musicians. And when they did an opening session for Iggy Pop, he actually came on and introduced the Student Teachers. And there you go, that's the sort of thing that Peter Gabriel did.
Yeah, that was it. I think, you know, you were musicians first.
Yeah.
And, you know, that everybody had that in common.
Yeah.
And everybody was interested. I mean, people were incredibly generous. I mean, I remember when, I mean, I only accidentally learnt to play the bass guitar. Because when Quiet Sun was formed back in 1970, the one thing we couldn't find was a bass player. We had a drummer, we had a guitar player, we had a keyboard player, we couldn't find a bass player.
But that's how my partner became a drummer. she learned to play the drums because they couldn't find a drummer.
The arrogance of being sort of 20 years old at the time, I looked at a bass guitar, there's only four strings, how difficult can it be?
Oh, dear.
So I said, look, they were all terribly complicated sort of 20-minute instrumentals. I'll just learn all the bass parts. And then we'll find a bass player at some later stage. So sure, 10 years later, you know, I was still playing bass, but you know, not quite in the same circumstances. So it was all accidental. So which is the reason why it's making it up as you go along. It's the title of the book.
It's the title of the book. Yeah. Bill, obviously, you're now just, when I say I'm a contemporary in terms of age, I can tell you that, but. One of the things that fascinated me, as I say, because of my recent introduction to the music scene from New York from the 60s and, well, obviously the late 70s there, and also my opportunity to be able to talk to somebody who was an engineer in London and just basically recorded everybody that was anybody back in the late 60s, early 70s. It's given me a whole fresher because I actually had a band back in the 60s called the Crow Janes when I lived in Guildford. You know, basically it was obviously a blues band, playing harmonica and stuff like that. And then in 1971, I actually had a recording studio in Northampton, and I recorded an album with a local band called The Dark, and the album was called Dark Around the Edges. And would you believe it? It's the only time I actually recorded a band because I set it up for sort of production work, which of course I got into radio. But 50 years later, that particular album, if you had an original copy of that album, and I did have a copy, don't know what happened to it, they were selling on Discogs for up to £25,000. I know.
You wish, eh? there's obscure stuff there that people subtly discover.
Yeah.
And there's so much stuff that really people don't know about.
Absolutely.
I'm sure that applies to all eras, but, you know... Yeah.
Particularly in that time, I think it was, because there was a lot of experimentation, there's still a lot of experimentation to do, which we're actually getting noticed even now. It's probably even more difficult because you actually have to sort of get your sort of face on the social media systems. And whereas back then you literally had to get a record deal to get any notice, didn't you? Or manage to sort of build yourself up in personal appearances. You had to do the stage shows. You had to do the live stuff all the time. Yeah.
I mean, without touring, without gigging, it was almost, and that's the problem. Like, Quiet Sun broke up because we just couldn't get the agents to be interested sufficiently. We couldn't get a record company. Ironically, we sent off demo tapes to everybody. The most unpleasant response we got from any record label turned out then to be the label that put out that Quiet Sun album, which was recorded 4 years later, which we thought was quite a nice irony. So we were quite happy to waive the rejection letter under the nose of the A&R man who had turned us down 4 years before.
That's how it goes, yeah.
But it wasn't quite the same as Decca turning down the Beatles back in 1962.
Absolutely. Oh, but I think they've ever forgiven themselves for that, have they? Even those executives who've passed on must be sort of rolling in their graves thinking,
oh, I'm sure, yeah. Spinning.
Yeah, spinning away. They're spinning away.
So playing live was the thing, and getting, you had to get a recording contract. And if you couldn't manage that, then, things just gently faded away. I mean, it was just various things like that happened to a couple of bands that I was in were unfortunately in that way, but it was an exciting time. I mean, I look back on the gigs that you used to go to, even if I was when you weren't playing. I mean, the lineups that you could go and see at places like the Lyceum in the Strand and other Middle Earth in Covent Garden, you'd be seeing four or five bands a night, all on their own, could headline.
Yeah,
fantastic nights.
I remember in the 60s, Bill, that I lived in Guildford, and it was basically called the Plaza Ballroom, but it actually was a blues club, and I literally saw the Stones there a few weeks before their first single came out, Come On. And also I saw a band there with Zoot Money, Long John Baldry, Reg Dwight on the piano.
The Reg, yes. Don't buy another name, but we can pass on that.
And yes, of quite. And I saw these American blues, Sonny Boy Williamson and Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. They looked ancient, and they're only in their 40s, because I'm a sort of a teenager, and I thought, God, these. And I thought they were still around 40 years later. I said, well, they're quite old now, but I thought they were really old back then. But I used to sit in the bar chatting to these monsters of the blues world. What I mean? And I sort of think back now to that era. I said, I was very fortunate that I was able to, get the opportunity to see these artists back then.
Surely.
The early Yardbirds and it was just astonishing. Bill, it's your book, A Short Social and Political History of Rock and Roll in South London, called Making It Up As You Go Along. What a great title. Congratulations to it.
Well, great. Thanks very much indeed.
Well, the book's available now through the bookstores, as we know. So go to TRE first, because it'll be available there, and go to the usual purchase places. And it's called Making It Up As You Go Along by Mill McCormick. That's M-A-C. Is it M-A-C-O-R-M-I-C-K?
It is
M-A-C-C. Okay, yeah. Matt McCormack. Anyway, just look for the title, Making It Up As You Go Along, and you'll find it easily. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And all of my interviews today have sort of brought back certain memories of things, and this is the best one, I think. It has to be.
It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you for having me on the show. It's been really good.
It's been great, Bill, and I wish you a lot of success with the book as well. I should look it up. Thanks so much for your time.
Okay, thanks so much. Yeah, cheers.
Welcome. Well, as we chatted about, Bill has a number of war books, including Pro Patria Mori, the 56th 1st London Division in Gomelcore, 1st of July 1916. Well, this was planned as the first of a series of books about the Battle of the Somme. Since then, he's published A Lack of Offensive Spirit, the 46th North Midland Division, the 1st of July 1916, and Z-Day, the 8th Corps at the Beaumont Hamel and Sierre, the 1st of July 1916. Well, also available is The Long Road to the Somme, 1870 to 1916, and De Jour, the French Sixth Army on the Somme, the 1st of July 1916. And of course, Making It Up As You Go Along and his military books are available at Bill McCormack, or Bill McCormack, it's BILLMACCORMICK.co.uk.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.